ghosts, UFOs, aliens, monsters, bumps in the night. It's easy to tell yourself that it's all make-believe. You have an overactive imagination. There's no such thing until there is. Welcome to Paranormal Patio, the podcast that brings you one step closer to the paranormal and occult, one patio at a time. Pull up a chair. In this episode, we're diving deep into the annals of history to uncover the terrifying tales of real-life monsters that have left their mark on our world. Joining us on this paranormal journey are our intrepid guides, Jason and Keith. Our first monstrous tale takes us to the rural river valley of the American Midwest, a land where legends are born. Picture this, a vast expanse of dark meadows and thick forests, where the leaves whisper secrets and the shadows hold untold horrors. And in the heart of this nightmarish landscape, there lurked a creature that could make the bravest of souls tremble. Big Jim. But that's not all, dear listeners. Our journey into the unknown doesn't end there. We'll also unravel the enigmatic and mystical ties of one of history's most intriguing figures, Rasputin, the healer, the mystic, and some say, a conduit to the supernatural. His story is laced with intrigue, betrayal, and whispers of dark rituals that would make your blood run cold. In the haunting twilight hours, an unsettling truth lingers just beyond the boundaries of our perception. It is said that monsters walk amongst us, their presence known only to those who dare to seek them. They dwell in the shadows, camouflaged within the mundane, biding their time until curious eyes pierce the veil. In that moment, when the heart races and the senses sharpen, the monsters emerge from the darkness. But they are not visible to all. Only those with the audacity to acknowledge their existence will glimpse the eerie reality that lurks beneath the surface of our world. Thus, we remain surrounded by the unseen, our reality a fragile construct, where monsters are as real as the darkness itself and come in many different forms.
Welcome back to Paranormal Patio. As always, I'm Jason, but guess what? I'm not alone. I've got someone very special with me here. He's going to be riding this season out with me. At least some of the episodes. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes this time.
This is my good buddy Keith. Keith, say hello.
Welcome, Paranormal Patio listeners.
Yeah, yeah. So we're doing something new this year. Obviously, if you are watching this on YouTube, all the episodes will be on YouTube with actual video and not just the equalizer nonsense that I've been doing in the past. But we will also be putting this out as a regular audio podcast, so no changes as far as that goes. But if you would like to watch the video version, head over to YouTube, look for Paranormal Patio, there we are. And you get all of this, I don't know, accoutrement, Keith. It's accoutrement. That's French for you, I think.
Yeah.
I think so, too. So, anyway, this episode is called Real Monsters, and we're going to be taking a look at a couple of things that I thought were interesting. My goal for this season was to do a weirdo story that's close to us without revealing our location, right? Mm-hmm. And tonight, that story will be coming out of around Carmi, Illinois, right, Keith?
Yep, Carmi, Illinois, and it is Real Monsters Big Jim.
Big Jim. Giant. Well, I won't spoil it. You'll find out what it is.
We'll get to that.
So, then the other half of the episode will be a story that I didn't know all the ins and outs of or that I had never heard of before that's from anywhere, like anywhere. And so on this episode, the second story will be the tale of Rasputin, Keith. Now, we all know a little bit about Rasputin, and you might think, why are we talking about Rasputin on a paranormal podcast? It's a little weird, right?
Yes, ties to our area, even.
That's true, and we're going to talk about that. But the thing about it is he had this sort of pseudo-religious, culty type of mysticism around him, which fits in perfectly for some of the themes that we've had on the show in the past. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get into that and find out what was really going on. So, all that being said, welcome to Paranormal Patio Season 5.
Episode 1.
Episode 1 of Season 5. And you get to look at our ugly mugs, all night. And that's great. and we're happy to have you here. Also, you know, make sure you follow us on all the socials, and we have a hotline this year I forgot about. I'll get you the number for that later in the episode. For right now, I think it's like, let's catch up. Keith, how you been, man?
Pretty good. Working. Same as you. Working hard. You've been traveling. I guess I travel a lot, too, being on the road, doing chores.
You travel for work. I travel for both. Yeah.
I do get some time, though. We went to some places between jobs. Went to Crab Orchard that day and ran around the muddy, Big Muddy that day. And
I definitely seen
the signs and all the Bigfoot stuff there. And everybody's seen that movie, too, if you haven't. Check it out. It's from the 70s.
And there's a really good documentary from, like, what, mid-2000s about the Big Muddy Monster?
Yep, Big Muddy Monster.
Really good. Classic Bigfoot type thing, but a really interesting story. With the main witnesses have no reason to lie about it.
No.
Not at all. I mean? You know, not at all. So,
State of Illinois, though, they come out and said, we have one of the highest Bigfoot sightings in all the country. So, I mean.
Really?
Yep. I imagine it's the river systems. We sat right between two of the biggest ones in the country, Mississippi, Wabash, down to Ohio. Yeah. They all connect.
Okay, question then for you. Poses a very interesting question. You say the river system's based on one of two things. One, it's a physical animal with river systems providing water and food for its prey, or the liminality of the rivers and the mystical nature of rivers and these energies that create these sort of portal type areas where something that's not physical could be coming through.
Yes.
Which one do you think it is?
Natural creature.
You think it's evolution. You're on team flesh and blood.
Flesh and blood. Remnants of the Ice Age.
Okay.
North America history is 500 years old, truly. Oh, what we have written down. So absolutely. I mean, and then the stories from before. Yeah. And so, yeah, remnants of the Ice Age, all the mammoths and everything. They find the mammoth bones. Sure. They found tool marks in the mammoths. So, knowing that people were here 100,000 years before they said they were. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I guess I didn't ever ask you before, but I didn't know you were on Team Flesh and Blood.
Team Flesh and Blood. Have been forever.
Oh, man. Now we're opposed from one another.
it's just the same with Dog Man, too. But Dog Man's the one you got to watch out for.
Yeah, we were just talking about a local dog man, so we may have to dig into more of the detail.
Dog man.
Yeah, I think we may have to look into that more because I had not heard of that before being here in our part of the state. That's weird.
Yeah, just some random guy that was talking about it, and I said, "Oh yeah." He's like, "Yeah, I've seen it." I was like, "Well, I've seen
it." Wasn't that same dude in the restaurant parking lot like a couple months ago?
That was listening to his talk. He knew. Trying to tell us these kids are going to war. My God, he was right,
man,
wasn't he?
Man, it's. Anyway, we got people here in Illinois.
yeah, lots of them.
Another thing that you alluded to that's totally off script was the woolly mammoth thing. And like you've been the only person who's told me about that woolly mammoth skull that somebody found around here.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's some dude has it up on his wall.
Yeah, it has it above his fireplace.
That's insane.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it was dug up here.
One of the gravel pits out there. They were working probably 80s, I imagine.
Oh, wow.
And then another guy I know that was also did that found a tusk years upon years ago. And, I mean, they found it. You went to the seminar about the mound builders, and they built the ones of incense, too. And so, I mean, it has to go back far. Why would that? They'd be here, especially, probably because right here, I imagine, once the glaciers did melt, they only went so far down. And all Illinois got flat. And that's why farmland's the way it is, Illinois and Indiana. So then they got crushed down to southern Illinois. So I imagine a lot of the mammoths were here, too, and got leveled from the glaciers.
Yeah, yeah. So the guy that has it up on his wall, is he like a super rich dude?
Yeah.
Like, okay. Yeah, I figured.
Richer family, yes. Yeah. Nice house, yeah.
Yeah, I figured as much. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, we are, but that's not what we're talking about.
That was in the days of running around with all the local bands and stuff. One of the guys that played in the local band.
All right. You have to tell me who that is off the air, because I think you've probably told me, but I forgot. Yeah. It's been a while since I've heard that story. Anyway, you want to kick things off with Big Jim?
Yes.
So, okay, little context. There is Keith is going to read you a rather extensive series of newspaper clippings that I've been able to dig up. Okay, these are historically printed newspaper clippings. it needs to be made perfectly clear that the words that Keith is about to read are not our own.
No.
There's just one thing that's a little questionable, but I don't think it's done in poor taste.
No.
And we're going to read it as is for the sake of, you know, being historically accurate.
Right, yeah.
You know, so. All right, man. Kicks off. Let's hear about Big Jim.
Big Jim, the bane of the Wabash.
Dude, he was.
Yeah.
He was.
Cattle. It was the early 80s that his reign of terror began. Although for years before it had been known to farmers in the northern part of the county that a huge serpent inhabited a section of the Skillet Fork Bottoms, which was thicketed, dotted with spurs of ragged, gnarled timber bluffs. When the high waters crowded rabbit and small game to the bluffs, they were noticed to disappear in a few days. Farmers began to wonder if the hawks and eagles that abound in those days carried off the game. The river, however, told a different story. Hundreds of dead rabbits were found floating as the waters receded. It was observed that buzzards would not eat the carrion. Old frontiersmen claimed that meat was poisoned or the buzzards would eat it. St. Louis Tribune, 1908. So they got all the way to St. Louis from here.
Yeah. It was big news at the time. We'll find out, but it's all over the place.
Big Jim, greatest rattlesnake in the world, terrorizes neighborhood of Carmi, Illinois. Believed to be 50 years old, has been notorious for a quarter of a century. Closed schools and destroyed the lumber industry.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, that scared of the snake. Holding his wooded throne on Rattlesnake Bluff near Carmi, Illinois, and defying the efforts of his enemies to destroy him. Big Jim, the monster snake of the Little Wabash, has this summer had uninterrupted sway in his dominion. Never in all his reign did King Charles rule with more cruel imperialism and arrogance than does the big king snake that basks in the summer sunlight 12 miles north of Carmi.
What a quote.
Yeah. Yeah, going all the way back to King Charles. For over 25 years, Big Jim has been the terror of the Wabash. Every known method of extermination has been tried, but in vain.
Oh.
The snake bears a life that is seemingly charmed, for none of his enemies have been able to conquer him, and none have caused him to retreat from his lair. Old legends of a quarter of a century ago tell of the snake. Mothers today have no trouble keeping their youngsters in at night when they tell them of terrible raids of Big Jim and his special fondness for little children. St. Louis Post-Dispatch, 26th of July, 1908. That's a good quote.
That's
there.
A great quote. That whole article is good.
Yeah, it is. The famous Rattlesnake Bluff on Little Wabash River near Fairfield has been dynamited and 69 monster snakes killed. The snakes have been escaping from their nests recently and biting and killing livestock for years. The bluff had been one of the showplaces of that part of the country. A big stone bluff, almost behind reach, has been resort of hundreds of snakes, and people could stand at a distance and see the reptiles move about on the bare stone. Many efforts have been made to break up the nest in the past. It is believed the use of dynamite will cause those not killed to leave the place. Mount Carmel, Illinois. Newspaper of the time. Not too far away from here.
Absolutely not, no.
Just straight south.
Oh, God. They're going to find us.
Yeah. Oh, you have to say it's Wabash Valley. And
yeah, right.
Yeah, that's where we're at. Well, I guess kind of a forgotten area. It was big time years ago. It was for the longest time. Absolutely. When they built the railroads and they built the refineries.
Yeah, oil was huge.
In the oil boom in the early 90s, mm-hmm. or 1900s.
Yeah. Yep.
Farmers made a raid on Rattlesnake Bluff on the Little Wabash River, a few miles northeast of Fairfield, and killed more than 100 poisonous reptiles. A charge of dynamite was placed under the bluff and exploded, and the river was filled with dead snakes.
That's insane.
That's a lot of snake. That's like Snake Road.
Yeah, I know.
Those that escaped the blast were clubbed to death by the hunters. The place had been infested with rattlesnakes for years, and many cattle, horses, and other livestock have been killed by them. Several hunters who ventured too close to the bluff have also been bitten. The Saturday Blade, a newspaper aimed at rural readers and once boasting the largest circulation of any weekly newspaper in the country. So that was the one that was going out to the farmers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And that's the kind of stuff they wanted to hear. They didn't give a crap what was going on in the city at the time. Like,
or politics or anything. No. Yeah. Mm-mm. Just how many dangerous snakes are there?
Yeah. Am I going to get my crop out, or am I going to get bit up by rattlesnakes?
Can we fill the river with rattlesnakes, or no?
And it's rattlesnakes is the big thing, because you go farther south, you get copperheads. You might see one here.
Sure.
But we're, like, they're going here, we're not rocky enough. Go to southern Illinois, yeah, they're everywhere. Yeah,
and Carmi's, you know, like, mid-south
Illinois. Mid-south Illinois, right. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
It's about an hour away from Garden of Gods, hour and a half.
Yeah.
Not too bad.
Yep.
In the early 80s, while saw logging was good on the Skillet Fork, and when the Little Wabash was a mecca of rivermen in early spring, when high water facilitated their work of rafting the long line of logs down to the Ohio, an incident occurred that established the significance of the snakes. This is no snake yarn, but is an actual occurrence. It can be vouched for by many of the old-time rivermen. Lots of the younger ones remember it. I was rafting a drift of logs down the stream early in May. The river was not so high and had been earlier in the spring. And I had several men along to guard against jams. And we had just got well into the stream when the blackened sky darkened our course. A very heavy spring rain set in and we towed to shore, trying to raft as securely as possible. We built a campfire under a ledge of the rock of the Rattlesnake Bluff, which our springs are pretty bad here with rain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially in the 1900s. Yeah,
this spring, too. It was wild.
It was pretty wild.
Wet and wild! Tornadoes, wet and wild. It was a good one. It had long been known to rivermen as an exceedingly dangerous place to stop, as hundreds of thousands of rattlers were known to infest the locality. They wriggled there in force in the fall and found excellent quarters to hibernate in the dense clusters of rock that jabbed the shore of the stream. And my crew was a great from Cincinnati. He was one of the largest men I'd ever saw, and as strong as a mule. He was of the superstitious type, and we deemed it prudent not to tell him of the slimy inhabitants of the bluff. It was his first trip, and he knew but little of the country. The boys called him Big Jim, and he was not incorrectly named.
Big dude.
Yep. Jim, go get some wood, one of the boys ordered as the fire began to grow dim. Big Jim, the man, refused, but eventually went up the bluff. He had probably got halfway up when we heard a startling cry. In the next instant, there was a splash in the stream as the plunged in head first. He was praying for deliverance. We had but a few minutes to wait until we understood the cause of the commotion. Sounding his rattles to the martial time, a bigger rattle was drumming for volunteers. In less than 15 minutes, the chorus was deafening as the serpents rushed to the place of alarm. We jumped into a boat that we had tied to the raft of logs and rowed to the west side of the stream. We had felt safe on the other side of the river as there were no rocks there, and as far as rivermen knew, no rattlers had ever been seen on that side. Rattlers do not like water and are the poorest kind of swimmers. In fact, they never take to the water unless forced. That's a lie. If it's coming like, right, they're coming from just the sound of the one, and they're coming in. They know the food's there.
That's terrifying. Imagine you're in the middle of nowhere. Even today, Carmi's nowhere.
Yeah, it's nowhere.
But back then, you're in the middle of nowhere, middle of the night, your fire is dying down. You hear a scream coming off in the distance from the dude who you sent to get firewood. You hear a splash in the water, and then you hear all these rattles go off, like calling back to one another. That would be absolutely terrifying.
And this is a little Wabash, too. So yeah. it's not very big. No. Yeah. It's a tributary of the Wabash itself. Yeah.
I mean, it's probably what? Like around, I'm trying to think, around Carmi, it's probably less than 400 feet wide.
Yeah. It gets until the mouth of it at the Ohio. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That's way further south. So.
Yeah. What? Past Mount Carmel?
Yeah.
Yep. In Princeton? But man, that reminds me of stories of the dodo birds. They did the same thing. Whenever they killed them all, I watched something on the other day. They'd make a high-pitched scream, all of them would come running, and that's how they killed them. Just wait there and then club them to death. God, no wonder they it's all
almost done. Like velociraptors. Like,
yeah.
Team, huh?
Yep. Uh-huh.
That's crazy.
Well, they said they lived in like families and stuff too, like in the wooded areas of the islands.
Yeah.
And just went island hopping to island hopping until they killed them all off.
Wow.
All night, we could hear the din across the stream. There must have been hundreds of snakes. Judging from the noise they made, When day broke, we went across to our logs, and several of the reptiles had crawled onto them. They were quickly killed, and in a few hours, ready to continue our journey. The bank was still lined with snakes, and along the number was one of the largest rattlers I ever saw. It must have been 7 or 8 foot long, and proportionally as large. We shot at it as we pulled out, but the shots went wild. We looked along the banks for Big Jim as we went down, but found no trace of the missing man. We finally concluded that he had been so intensely frightened when he fell into the stream the previous night that we had made his way to the bank and left for Carmi, 8 miles below. Yeah, God, just walking straight. So they would still be on the Illinois side then.
Yeah, would have been.
So he'd have went up and walked all the way down the... Which, Route 1 would have been built at that point in time, right?
I don't know.
We'd have to look. Because... I'm pretty sure.
You can bet your ass he wasn't walking the banks of the river when he got out.
No. No. Well, I'm pretty sure that was some of the first roads Abraham Lincoln built when he took over as governor of the state of Illinois.
I mean, being that it runs the length of the state, I would imagine.
Because I know one of them was the first ones he built was out of Vincennes. That's where the Buffalo Trace Road comes from.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, let's take a break. We're going to find out. I'm going to look it up right now.
Okay.
For the benefit of everyone watching at home, we're going to find out.
Yeah, because what year did it say at the beginning? So, 1908?
I'm trying to find out when it was built. History. Illinois 1 was commissioned in 1918.
So, it wouldn't have been nothing but dirt roads then?
Yep. Yep.
And everything leading to Vincennes still probably then?
Yes. Absolutely what it says.
Okay.
Well, now we know. Yep. I bet it was close.
Yeah.
You were almost there.
I was almost there.
That's why I hired you.
That's probably why they built them.
So you could escape Carmi.
Yeah. That snake pit.
Get out of here, man.
Well, I guess that's... They do call the stadium in Mount Carmel the snake pit, too, though.
They do.
They are playing state this next weekend, too.
Oh, good for them.
Yep. We would agree that we would search for the saloons for him, and search for him we did. Our quest was in vain. No one had seen him. Had he indeed lost his life? Next day came, and still nothing from Big Jim. Farmers who lived near the bluff had not seen anything of him, and the story of his disappearance was causing a panic among the black community all over town. The news leaked out in a hurry, and finally they got it that he had been devoured by the big rattler that was reputed to rule the bluff.
Hmm.
Reputed, by the way. I'm just going a little fast there. Can this guy read? To just ease matters, we sent some of the boys up to look for the body. Nothing could be found of him, and the men returned with the news. Consternation seized the river rats and paralyzed the log business. Most of the laborers employed in skidding down the drifts had been of the Ethiopian hue. But as the story of the Big Jim's fate spread, the blacks grew restless when the name of Rattlesnake Bluff was mentioned. Thousands of logs lay in the stream all year, and lots of the white people, too, became apprehensive of the bluff.
I can't see why.
I can't see why either. And in the early 1900s, this was after Revolutionary War, so that's a lot of the black people from the South would have been moving up
Civil
to.
Civil War, you mean?
Or Civil War, yeah. Yeah, it would have been Civil War, 1865, so yeah, roughly. So I guess that's 40 years later, but...
Still.
But still, yeah.
Yeah, there was a surprising amount, actually, because, like, where we are, I know we're further north than that. We're like, you know, we're between Chicago and this, right? So, there's not a lot of racial diversity here.
Not where now. We are. There was, though, then.
Right. But you go back and you start looking around and digging stuff up, and it's like, oh, man. Like, I didn't realize at one point we were.
Yeah,
it was all the labor stuff. Like, it was the lumber. It was the oil. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, all that stuff. And
an underground railroad.
Yeah.
Ran out of incense.
On Route 1.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, what would become Route 1?
Would become Route 1.
Obviously, because we've already established it was not a road yet.
Yes.
But. Yeah, because you have the Crenshaw House.
Yep.
That's on Route 1.
It's on Route 1. Yeah. You have Dunlap, what used to be called Dunlap Station, went to Pinkstaff.
Yeah, yeah.
And where the Tan Cemetery is, and that was the black settlement at the time.
Yeah.
And They went through there, too, and then escaped to Michigan. Yep. At the Wabash.
Crenshaw House, obviously, was the reverse underground railroad.
Yes.
Terrible, terrible, nasty dude.
Yep.
Which I think we talked about in an episode last season, so
go back. Yeah, the Crenshaw House.
Yeah. Anyway.
A Cincinnati paper, I remember, got a hold of this story and made a big write-up over the affair. Big Jim was pictured in the mouth of the big snake, and that was enough to send spasms of fear thrilling through the people. In the succeeding fall, the big snake did do a stunt or two that forged his name for art time to come. Scores of cattle and hogs died under circumstances indicating poisoning, and the blame was finally traced down to the rattler. Someone had called the snake, and in horror of man, it drove away, and it began to be known as Big Jim. The Times, Shreveport, Louisiana, May 5th, 1907.
Yeah, so just a little ways before the road was built.
Yeah.
So that's crazy, though.
So news took a while to spread then. So 1907, 1908, this probably happened a few years before then.
Sure. Who knows for sure.
One of the men saw the big snake perched on the bluff and swore that he had Big Jim's skull and his coils playing with it. The story had the effect we had worked too hard to dispel. Every black man as far down as Shawneetown heard of the affair, and all of them steered clear of the place. It ruined the rafting business, which had just now got good again. That one fact saved the vast timber resources of the Skillet Fort from devastation long ago. And to this day, none of the old-time blacks will venture as far up the stream as the bluff. So they all stay down in southern Illinois because of the big snake.
Now we know why there's so much less racial diversity. Yeah, they don't want
it's the rattlesnake. It's that bluff. Drawing that guy drew.
It's got to be it, man.
Nope. William Ude, near whose farm the retreat of Big Jim is located, has for 20 years worn boots to guard against snake bites. Hundreds of rattlesnakes abound on the bluff, and last year Ude killed over 300 while breaking wheat ground. Gee, so that's
a lot of snakes.
That's a lot of snakes in a year, yeah. The following winter, Farmer Ude made a large case and placed it over the mouth of Big Jim's lair, hoping to catch him as he came out in the spring. The iron bars, however, were cracked and twisted past recognition, and the monster serpent was again at large.
I don't know how I feel about that.
I don't either. Something else was up in that cage. Mad as hell.
Could have been a bear.
Could have been. Yeah, we'd probably still had a few bears then. Few wolves, maybe, but a wolf wouldn't have done that. More like a black bear. He is known to be over 25 years old and was fired upon by Leroy L. Staley, the sheriff of White County, in 1883. Last fall, James A. Welsh, city treasurer of Carmi, was almost scared out of his wits by the rattler. Washington Post, 1908. So 1883 was his first sighting.
Yeah, sounds like it.
One of them, many. Well, he said he believed to be 50 years old, so God, it could have been during the Civil War.
Yeah. God, imagine you're out there fighting the Civil War and your buddies are getting picked off one by one.
One by snakes. Kind of like the old World War II and the alligators against the Japanese.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah, saltwater crocs. Oh, boy.
Anyway.
Arai, one of the oldest living stagecoach drivers in Illinois, was driving a traveling man to Centerville. When the snake appeared in the road, the horses reared and plunged, breaking from the control of Uncle Tom and running away. The traveling man had climbed a tree and would not get down until early night. The horse ran back to town and would never go past the place where the snake was seen again. Centerville, so that'd be over by Princeton.
Yeah.
So that's over in Indiana.
Yep.
So he's got a terror on him. He's roaming.
Dude, snake like that's got to roam.
Uncle Tom well remembers the snake and could give a better description of him than anyone. While nearly everyone that tells Big Jim is much larger than he really is believed to be, most all agree that he lay over 10 feet in length and proportionally large. Some claim he's nearly twice that large, but Uncle Tom says 10 or 12 feet is large even for Big Jim. Yeah, that's just like fishing story. I caught a fish as big.
Yeah.
A country school 4 miles from Rattlesnake Bluff was the next site of report. Big Jim was spotted nearby, and the frightened teacher gathered the students inside, shut the blinds, and hid out until evening. When parents came to see what the problem was, school was dismissed for the rest of the year.
Oh, man.
So that'd been spring if they're talking about it.
Yep. Probably.
Big Jim finally put to rest. shortly after the account of his history had been told to in the commercial. On the W.H. Thompson farm in southwestern Sullivan County, farmhand John Bascom heard a commotion in the pig pen. A boar had a giant rattlesnake in his jaws, close enough to the head that the snake couldn't get in a knockout punch. By the time he had returned with a rifle, the other hogs in the pen were in the fray, stomping and biting at the writhing snake. Bascom finally got a clear shot, and the snake was finished. Bascom mounted the skin, which measured 12 feet 5 inches and had 29 rattles.
That's
whether Big Jim or just a rattler, the legend of the terror of the Wabash died in Sullivan County pig pen. Folklore, tall tales, and interact case books of Knox County, Indiana. So that's... That might originally came from that book, that Vincent's book I was telling you about.
Maybe, yeah.
It was the French guy, so it was all mixed English and it was but he tells that there's a story in there that tells of the giant wolf on the back road, which would have been where Route 1 is now.
Mm.
And it was kind of eerie because it's kind of like the, what's that freaking ranch out there where the wolf comes up?
Skinwalker Ranch?
Yeah, the big wolf. Yeah. That's exact same, but this guy's walking to Vincent's at night. From one of the little Russellville small towns.
We're going to talk about the Lugaroo Vincennes in a future episode. So remind me and we'll make sure we add that when we're talking about it. That's a good story.
And it comes all the way from the French forts all the way up the river from Kekionga, Weotnon to Vincennes.
Yeah. Yeah. The terror of the Wabash put to rest by a tribe of pigs.
They eat anything. Stomped it to death.
So you, fun fact for everybody, you're the one who told me the story originally, and I had no idea about it. You just brought it up, like...
Hey, from one of them historical sites, or from that me telling you about Google Books and finding those old books from Vincent's whenever, right after the whole George Rogers Clark and all that went on, and if anybody knows the history of that, that was a big deal here.
Sure.
That's what... That's what made this area America. They signed the Treaty of the Treaty of Paris is when they got Vincennes.
I think
it was the first part of it that was put in there in the Treaty of Vincennes or Treaty of Paris, and then the British come and took Vincennes, and the War 1812, and then the Americans come, and George Rogers Clark, and then the French locked the doors when the. They came through and they fought the British, and the French people all signed the Oath of Allegiance to the United States of America, which they were probably sign it or die. I imagine they were burning people to stake. They
had death
all over the place. I had relatives that were burning to stake.
It's crazy.
Yep. Fallen Rock and up at LaSalle at the, what is that? Prairie de Rocher?
Is that how it's said?
I don't know. I don't speak French. Anyway, I should, though. Yeah,
right. Like, so Keith and I are driving back home from Southern Illinois one day, and we're coming through Carmine. He's like, oh, you're here about Big Jim? And I'm like, no. obviously, neither one of us knew all of this stuff about it.
I just had skimmed through it and one of the late nights.
That's what inspired me to look into it. And I was like, this is a really interesting story. It's, it's a monster that's terrorizing an entire a county and multiple counties. I mean, there's all these stories. You kids are being told if you don't come in by, dark, the Big Jim's going to get you and all this stuff. And it's kind of got this folklore around it. And all these newspaper clippings and stories that have been written that, probably just a really big snake.
Yeah.
Taken care of.
I've seen one rattlesnake here. My entire life. I mean, I've moved around some through the years, but I've been here most of the time, and I've seen one, and that was here. So, I mean.
I'll cut that out.
Okay. I'll cut that out.
Anyway.
I forget.
Yeah.
It's all right, though.
Yeah. Anyway, I've never seen any, and it makes me wonder, though, the amount of time I've spent in Shawnee, how many I've walked past and not seen.
You've seen them. Yes. Same here.
I've seen some wild snakes down there.
And I think about it, too, like all the times I spent walking through the mountains in Tennessee, too, up like Cherokee Lake.
Oh, sure.
And like, I remember I went up there one time, and I went out in the woods as bored. I was probably 20. I was young, actually, 18 or 19, living down there with my mom. And there was like a rock that was carved into like a chair. it was the wildest thing. I was like, someone had to have done this. And it was just off, like looking off through the mountains out in the woods.
That's awesome.
And it looked like just a old 70s chair with no legs sitting on the ground. I sat in there for a while, smoked a couple of cigarettes, had a few beers.
That's awesome. All right. We are going to take a little break and bring you a special interview. All right, Vincent, welcome back to the Paranormal Patio, my friend. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Jason. Happy to be here.
How is it hanging up there in the trees?
Well, we have trees in the city of Milwaukee, but, you know, oh, wait, I'm in a magical forest. Never mind.
You are. Never mind the glowing red eyes beneath you. I'm sure it's fine.
I'm sure it's fine. Adventure awaits.
Always, especially here in the Paranormal Patio. It's so great having you back, and just had a chance to recently do an episode of your show, and it's always a great time. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was very nice. You were excellent.
It's always a good time. And I was so happy to finally get to meet you at Strange Realities in Nashville this year. You had been previously in person. It was the year before I started going. So then I had two and you weren't there. And then this year we were both there and it worked out great. That was an absolute pleasure to finally to meet you.
Same here, man. It was really nice. It was really cool. I had a great time hanging out with you.
What would you say your favorite part of Strange Realities is? Not necessarily like your favorite presenter or anything like that, but like what is it that really draws you to coming back?
It's the kinship. It's you go in there, and it's almost like you don't need introductions. Now, to you, I already knew virtually, but even to people I'd never heard of, you're all there. It's like the best family reunion ever, like the best club meeting ever. And you suddenly go there, and like the 1% stuff that you talk about, everybody talks about. And it's just such a... It's such a great environment. It's really positive. We all have these eclectic, paranormal, whatever that may mean, interests. And yet everybody's really cool with each other. I can't say there's any negativity. It was just great. It's like coming home every time I go there.
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel exactly the same way. And it's so good to have that type of situation, because I've expressed a lot of times, being into the things that we're into can be incredibly lonely, because especially when you're deep in the weeds, like some of us are, guilty right here.
Oh, yes. Same here. You know, I mean, you take can't it to relate another to level, anyone. You know?
You can't relate to anyone. And you find yourself just wanting to talk about some of these things, or to even better, to hear other people talking about them, right?
Yes.
Do you think that's better?
Yes. I mean, I can talk to myself all day, but that just makes people think I'm weird. When you get 30 other people and they know what you're talking about. They get the references. They get, even if they don't get all of them, they get the general idea. And this is not your, you know, county fair, Sasquatch in a box of ice. This is, you know, people who've really spent usually much of their lives reading about this stuff and watching stuff, serious stuff about this. And then you all come together and it's like you're all in the same space and it's wonderful.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree. Besides yourself, I finally got to meet Adam Taula in person, who started out our friendship on this show all the way back in the first Hair-Raising Horror Week event that I did for their show. And, you know, it was great to actually finally meet him in person, to meet you in person, to meet Tobias in person, to see Nathan and Darian, who I see multiple times a year at this point, to see Steve Berg again. And, you know, Steven Snyder again, who always pops up wherever I go. Like if I go to Somerset for some random thing, there he is.
Totally, you know, unannounced and unplanned.
He's like, in real life. And it's, yeah, he's a really cool guy. And
absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, it was great, man. I met so many people and it was awesome.
Yeah. New friends, old friends every time. And, it was so great. That first year, I think that I went, or maybe it was the second year, when Alan Greenfield was there as a speaker, getting to actually meet Alan Greenfield was cool to me. Super cool. And it's like only the people that are into this stuff would appreciate that. You know, I can't tell people in my family or people at work for the most part how important that was to me, because they don't get it. You know what I mean? That's too far down the road.
What you know precisely what you mean, because I met him literally, Alan Greenfield, in 21. And yeah, it was a huge experience for me that I can tell almost nobody who didn't go to this thing about and have them get it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Just terrific. Just every time I've been has just been great, you know, and I hate Nashville with a passion. I just don't like being there. So I tend to not leave the conference as often as like I focus on staying there, you know, because I don't want to go out into the city. I just don't care for it. I'm not from the city, you know, or any city really. And so being in a city environment is not my favorite thing.
Well, Nashville, good and lost, so that was a plus.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, it was a nightmare. I had to take an Uber just to get back to the event. It was crazy.
But oh my goodness!
It all worked out. It was fine. No, I had a wonderful time.
It wasn't based on the directions I gave you for the Burger King and the gas station, was it?
It was based on my absolute lack of sense of direction. Oh, okay. That's all it was. No, it was.
Last thing I needed was guilt.
No. And I only walked like two blocks in the wrong direction, and I was in the wrong direction. But anyway,
uh-huh. Yeah,
got back.
It's not hard to do.
No problems. It was great, man.
You should have said something. I would have walked with you, man. I've got a keen sense of direction. Anyway, no, it was a blast. So you are the guest spot in this episode about real monsters. Okay.
All right.
We have just talked about Big Jim, who was a monster rattlesnake that terrified the entire town of Carmi, Illinois, and shut down the logging industry in the late 1800s. Shut down a school for a year. All kinds of great things. The stories about him were very monstrous. And he has been succumbed by climbing into a pig pen, getting into a tussle with a boar, and then being shot. So the legend of Big Jim dies in a Sullivan County pig pen. But we're going to be talking about Rasputin in the next clip.
Oh,
so wow. This is the theme of the show, of the episode that you're on. And I wanted to have you retell your story about seeing the bear / Bigfoot with your wife, you know, that you told back in, I believe, Hair Raising Horror Week 3.
Yes. Now, I don't consider myself any kind of experiencer. I have had exactly one cryptid sighting in my life, and this was that. This was Mother's Day weekend, 2019. So I can give a specific date that happened. And this was in Richland County, Wisconsin, which is the far southwest side of Wisconsin, extremely rural. And it's the driftless region, which means it's not the flat cornfields that I grew up in, but it's hills. It is vaguely physically similar to Appalachia. And my wife was driving, but I was awake and right next to her. And we're on the kind of roads they have there, which is, you know, one lane going each way. And there's a rock wall on one side and a drop off on the other. And it's commonplace in that area. It's farming country, but it's really hard to farm because the hills are so steep that it's common to plant crops at the bottom of the hill and then maybe 2/3 of the way up stop. And then the top of the hill will be wooded. And we're driving along, and all of a sudden, and this only lasted about 5 seconds, but it was clear. We had a clear view, and we saw what we saw, and we both discussed it extensively, and this was not a glimpse of an eye. This was several seconds, and we saw that there was a cornfield. There's approximately 100 yards of open, you know, field where there's nothing growing, and then there's a wooded area. And all of a sudden, running as fast as it could, a huge creature came out of the cornfield and crossed into the open area, and then had to hop its way up to, because the hills are that steep, into the wooded area, and then disappeared into the woods. But we both got a good look at it, and we didn't discuss it right at the time. We would have liked this. It was gone by that point. We would have liked to have stayed there and looked into it further, but we had cars behind us and you have no turning and we had to leave. But once we got back to the motel, and I didn't ask her any questions because I didn't want to bias what she saw, because I know what I saw, but I had been into this enough to know, don't ask leading questions. Ask, what did you see? And she answered immediately, I saw Bigfoot. That's what I saw. I saw Bigfoot. And she described the Bigfoot that she saw as looking like the character in the current version of the Planet of the Apes, not the 70s one, but the one that is now, that is multicolored and looks like a baboon. The baboon from Planet of the Apes. And it was very clearly a hominid to her. It was very clearly a primate. And she said that it usually walks on its hind legs, but it was, to get up the hill, it had to get on all fours and kind of hop, which was the same motion that I had seen. But what I had seen was more like a bear. Well, it was a bear. It was a huge mutant bear, because it wasn't like a bear that exists in nature. It was multicolored in a way that bears aren't both black, brown, and gold. And it bears in anything around Wisconsin are not the size of a small car. Okay, it was gigantic. And this gigantic bear that runs as fast as it can, and then it's too steep, so it has to hop. And I remember the hopping motion too, where it's on all fours and it's hopping. We saw similar, but not exactly the same things. And I thought maybe it was because my mind couldn't handle seeing a full-on primate Bigfoot. And maybe a bear was the most I could take. But that's what we saw. But we saw it very clearly. And, I mean, thank God she was there, because otherwise I thought I might just be losing my mind, you know? And
right, right.
But we did see the same. We saw roughly the same thing or a similar things at the same time, but they were separate things. They were not exactly the same. And that's the only cryptid sighting I've ever had in my life, but it was extremely intense. And it was 100% real. It was as clear as anything that I could see today. It was not, you know, an ethereal vision. It was literally happening physically at that moment.
Yeah.
And that's how long it lasted. We never saw it again. But we did see it at that time. And I didn't have the impression, and I didn't get any messages from it. Some people do. I didn't get anything like that. But I just had the impression that it realized we could see it and wanted to get out of sight. And it did very quickly, like about 5 seconds, it got out of sight. And I was, you know, I didn't feel any fear, nor did she, as far as she could say, because it was running away from us. Had it been charging us, I felt very different. But it seemed like it just wanted to get out of sight. And that was my experience.
And it's a great story too, man. And I thought, for a while now, that whatever this other is, you know, some people call it like the field or the spiritual realm or whatever, whatever it is. No one knows, right? No one has level of contemplation, right? I think that a lot of the things that we see are all different presentations of the other, right? And it presents itself in different ways at different times for different reasons based on a multitude of different factors. I think mental health, I think geology, I think body chemistry, I think mood, I think like your psyche at the time, your emotional state. Even to go further, I think astrological things can affect the presentation. And I think, you know, you see UFOs, you see Bigfoot, you see ghosts, you see balls of light. I think it's all the same thing. And I think it just presents itself to you based on the recipe that you're capable of most likely comprehending and getting something out of it. Because if it's going to make a show for you, what's the point if not for you to get something out of it? Whether that be fear or interest or curiosity or inspiration, something is going to happen when it makes this show. And I think that's why some people don't experience things, is because for whatever reason, they just aren't lined up with what's available at the time. To take it back a little ways, you know, we used to have the TV antennas, right? And just because you could only pick up two different TV stations on your television with the bunny ears does not mean that those were the only two broadcasts going on at the time. There's likely, you know, over 100 going on at the time. You just weren't capable of receiving those. You only got the two that you got. And, you know, maybe three if you wrapped yourself in aluminum foil and touched the TV and stood there.
That's
like
a great analogy for those that can get it. Yes, that absolutely, I believe that's how it works.
And I love stories like that where multiple witnesses encounter the other and have different presentations made on what it is. I absolutely love that. There's several stories that are that way. And one of my favorites is in an old hotel out in the desert. And there's like three people there and they all have this terrifying encounter with this creature. And all three of them have a completely different, totally different description of what they saw. But it was doing the same thing in all three events, all three cases at the same time in the same place. And it had a totally different appearance. And I love whenever people have that experience, man. It just, to me, because I'm biased because it drives home my theory that it's all the same thing.
That makes a ton of sense to me. And yes, I love those stories too. And that, you know, something happened. Something definitely, there's no doubt that something happened. But what happened is a great matter of interpretation.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I think that's part of our experience, man, is to make these interpretations of encounters with the other. I think that's part of why we're here. Yes. It's a glimpse at godliness, I think, in a way. You know, we all have different interpretations for everything. It's a brush with the divine, I guess. Or I'm totally wrong and I'm just an idiot in a cornfield that is trying to make up depth here. I don't know which it is.
That's a little harsh. It's at least noumenal. Shall we call it noumenal?
We'll call it noumenal.
Average, you know. And I've wrecked my brain, I can tell you. And she and I come from the rural environment. I know what a cow looks like. I know what a pig looks like. I know what an actual bear looks like. I've seen them in the wild, and that was not that. None of these things. And I went through just everything that could possibly be. And no, it was none of those things for either of us.
Yeah. I've only had one experience that was even close to that. And it's really boring by comparison. But a friend of mine and I had to have been in college at this point. We were driving home on a back road, country road from one of the near big towns back home. And I saw in the dark, it was nighttime, coming up on an S curve in the road, I saw a turkey in the road, which is really common around here. We have a lot of turkey. So I didn't think much of it, but then she screamed and I was like, calm down. It's just a turkey. And she goes, what turkey? And I said, in the road, isn't that what you were screaming about? And she said, no, I saw a giant animal outside of your window. And I thought, well, hold on a minute. Like this doesn't make any sense to me. We saw it in different places. And, like we talked about, I pulled over, I doubled back to see if either one of them were still there. No turkey, no giant animal. And I'm all the way home, I'm thinking, like, what animals do we have here that would make up the height for this description of what she saw? And it couldn't have been a dog, because a dog wouldn't have been at the eye level that she saw it at. It wouldn't have been a cat. Even a big cat wouldn't have been that tall. It wasn't a deer, although the height would have been similar. It was bigger. What she saw was bigger than a deer. We don't have any moose. We don't have any giant elk. On occasion, we have a bear. Like once every 40 years, a bear will wander through here. So that was the closest thing I could think of. So we got home and I got on my computer and I opened up Photoshop. I went out to my car, and from the passenger seat, I took a picture out from inside the car to outside that window. Okay. I brought that picture into Photoshop, and then I got a picture of a bear and I put it behind my window and I added some eye shine to it. And I was like, this is, to me, is my interpretation of what she explained. And I showed it to her. And she said, oh, my God, that's exactly what I saw.
Oh, wow.
So then my guess is there was a bear just passing through here and it was going after that turkey. And I drove right in between the two and I saw the turkey and she saw the bear. And that's where I'm landing on it. I don't think it was a paranormal situation. I was hoping it was. But after meticulous Photoshop research, okay, I don't believe that was the case.
I'm going to level with you, Jason. I think the odds of that happening and you being there at that moment are less than it likely it was a paranormal incident. Okay.
It might be. Okay. It might be. You might be right.
Because a bear showing up and going for the turkey and you drive between them, I'll just call that a paranormal incident. The odds that would happen, you know.
You might be right. I'm still not going to classify it as anything near the caliber of the cryptid sighting that you had, which has become one of my favorite stories I've got from the show.
Well, thanks, man.
It goes back to that weird state of multiple witnesses observing a different event at the same time in the same place. I love those.
Same here. Same here. And if I may just elaborate a little bit on your experience, maybe she had a higher fear level, because I know yours is really low.
Oh, well.
You don't get scared.
What's fear?
Exactly. And so she saw something big and scary, like a bear with eye shine, and you saw something kind of ridiculous, like a bold turkey that I'm well familiar do stand in the street sometimes.
Yeah, they're dumb.
Yes.
But it was like I saw the turkey ahead and to the right, and she saw the bear directly left. So not even in the same place, but not to discount my theory here, I guess. I mean,
no, I mean, that could have totally happened. I mean, yeah. I'm sure that's, I mean, the skeptics would say, oh, you just drove between a bear and a turkey. That's all.
But right. Yeah.
That could have happened. And that's one possible.
I agree. The odds are incredibly slim.
You know, that you would be there right then. And not
it's hit almost one cartoonish, the really, to think about.
What's that?
It's almost cartoonish to think
about.
Yeah,
you know, but hey, it's not impossible.
Oh, man. But no, I love those stories, and I wanted to have you tell that on this episode, because this episode is really about taking an event or a person or a creature or a monster, really, a real monster, and looking at it from different angles. You know, you had a big snake that shut down a logging industry and had this reputation of being a monster when it turned out to just be a snake, a big snake, but a snake. And then a lot of people look at Rasputin as a monster because of rumors based on jealousy. And I think it's important to look at every side of that and to see potentially what could have been a man who was just rolling with it because it was a good time and not trying to openly discredit the people that were trying to openly discredit him.
It's an absolutely fascinating juxtaposition, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. It came by random. that was kind of the theme of this episode, is to look at monsters from different perspectives and see the real behind the monster. And I thought that that was a fitting story and conversation to interject between the two stories here. And I want to thank you so much again for coming on and telling the story again, not only for the benefit of the show, but because I enjoy it so much.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I could talk about this all day. Thank you for having me.
Before I cut you loose and we get into Rasputin, could you tell everyone about your show, what it's about, where they can find it, and all the good stuff?
Yes. I'm host of The Weird Part with Vincent Treewell. It's a podcast. It's available on most podcatchers. As, like Jason, it's not on Apple for just reasons. It's everywhere else. And I have a YouTube channel. Just look up Vincent Treewell and put it in quotation marks so they can find me. And they won't be looking for trees or Vincent Van Gogh or something. And so I have the YouTube channel. I have the podcatchers. And there's Vincent Treewell at WordPress.com. And I'm on Patreon. My Patreon is free at this moment, but when this is broadcast, it may or may not be. And ooh, there's another platform opening up soon that we're both going to be on that Jason can probably tell you about as it unfolds. But yes, that's where you can find me. Also, if you want to send me something, VincentTreewell@gmail.com. And I am really hoping to hear stories from people that have seen and experienced things. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Vince.
All right. We're back. All right. No one panic. We're going to talk about Rasputin here for a minute. We're going to
try this again.
Take two. No, we're growing pains. So, all right. Now, why are we talking about Rasputin? Because this is a paranormal show. We kind of talked about it earlier, but you're going to find some things in here that you might not have known about Rasputin. Most people just know the song.
Yes.
You know, which actually.
Boney M?
Yeah, dude. Did you know that the lead singer of Boney M, who sings the Rasputin song, that he died? Okay. I gotta verify this information. Okay.
Same day that Rasputin was killed?
Okay. Hold on. I looked this up a long time ago by happenstance, and I know this. He died on the morning of the 30th of December 2010 in a hotel room in St. Petersburg, Russia, of heart failure. His body was discovered by hotel staff after he failed to respond to an alarm call. Coincidentally, he died on the same date and in the same city as Rasputin.
Oh, boy.
The subject of one of his group's most iconic songs, and who he had dressed as in some live performances.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug.
Dude, you've isn't that wild, though? Like,
yeah, that is.
Isn't that just bizarre?
Same town, same day.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. That's insane.
Yeah, that's one of them things in history. It's like, no.
And then, I know. Like, what are the odds? And then another thing that we wanted to talk about was, his daughter, Maria, right? And how she had ties to like our area, roughly. We looked it up at one point.
What was it? The Bell Circus or something? We looked it up at one point in time. She was a circus performer, dancer, an acrobatic.
I'm going to find out because it's important.
I'm pretty sure that's the circus that had the
Bush
big,
Circus.
Yeah. They had the big accident in Chicago and it killed a lot of the circus workers in train yard fire.
Yes, yes.
And I'm pretty sure that is the same circus that Red Skelton worked for before he got his own TV show and everything. And the Red Skelton show. And
yeah.
Because he comes from there, from around where we live.
Yeah.
So the bridge is named after him.
Yeah. That's, two like crazy coincidences, you know, like totally unrelated coincidences, nevertheless. Anyway, so let's talk about Rasputin here. Grigory Yefimovich Rasputin was born January 21st, 1869 in Siberia. He lived a relatively poor and normal life until he became a wandering, self-proclaimed holy man, Keith, at the age of 28 after going on a pilgrimage that gave him a religious awakening.
He's going to be holy man.
Yeah, he's going to end up holy, for sure. One thing that can be said about him, that's the truth. So, while shorter pilgrimages were not foreign to Rasputin, this particular visit to the St. Nicholas Monastery in 1897 was definitely a special one, because when he came back, he was a changed man, right? He met this Makari. This guy was a starets, or an elder, that Rasputin was impressed and humbled by. And he comes rolling back into his hometown of Pokrovskoy, you know, Russians. I'm going to butcher every name in this literary work that I wrote. Came back a changed man, looking disheveled and behaving differently. He no longer ate meat or drank alcohol, and he was now praying and singing more than he had prior to his trip. In less than 30 years, Rasputin had a small circle of followers who prayed with him on holy days, and when he wasn't out traveling the country, he had this little makeshift chapel built in his father's root cellar, and the group held these secret prayer meetings there. To the suspicion and hostility of the village priest, of course, it was rumored that his fellow female followers.
There was a lot of secret sex going on at that time. You know, Society of Friends was going on before then, and then through Cromwell.
Sure.
Then you had, like, Crowley and the...
Dilemma?
What is it? Golden Dawn.
Golden Dawn.
And...
Yeah.
Then the Freemasons at the point in time, the Oddfellows, which you don't really see that much anymore.
I was just talking to somebody about that the other day.
You don't see Oddfellows anymore.
They're still around, though.
They are, but you don't really see the... Not like they used to be here, where it was more Oddfellows than Freemasonry.
All speculation, Keith.
All speculation.
And this priest was speculating that these female followers were ceremoniously washing Rasputin before these meetings. And that they sang strange songs, you know. Before long, there were even rumors that Rasputin had joined the Kleisti. The Kleisti was a religious sect known for its ecstatic rituals, self-flagellation, and orgies. All the good stuff. All the hits.
Oh, really. Yeah. All the fun things.
There has been no concrete evidence that Rasputin was, in fact, a member of this sect, or that these rumors weren't just exactly that. Rumors. Now, this is building block number one. On Rasputin's reputation.
Of evilness.
Siberia would soon be more aware of Rasputin and his charismatic activities during the early 1900s, and at some point he made another trip, another special trip, to Kazan. Here he began to acquire the reputation of that of a wise elder himself, who people hoped would resolve their spiritual anxieties. Even though the rumor mill was running even wilder at this point, he managed to befriend Archimandrite Andrei and Bishop Chrysanthos, who were so impressed by Rasputin that they introduced him to Bishop Sergei, the rector of the theological seminary at the Alexander Nevsky Monastery. He was also introduced to Archimandrite Theophan, who was well-connected in St. Petersburg. Theophan was so impressed with Rasputin that he invited him to stay in his very own home, and this connection became one of the most important ones he would ever make in the early 1900s. Gaining him entry to many of the influential meetings of the local aristocracy. In these meetings, Rasputin attracted more and more influential followers that would later turn against him, as we will soon learn together. Alternative religious movements, such as spiritualism and theosophy, had become popular among St. Petersburg aristocracy before Rasputin's arrival, and many of the aristocracy were intensely curious about the occult and the supernatural. Rasputin's ideas and strange manners made him the subject of intense curiosity among the city's elite, who were bored, cynical, and seeking new experiences. And they got that, I think, in spades with Rasputin. By 1905, Rasputin had formed friendships with several members of the aristocracy, including the Black Princesses, Militsa and Anastasia of Montenegro, who had married cousins of Tsar Nicholas II, and were instrumental in introducing Rasputin to the Tsar and his family. This is like building block number two, is people are looking for this type of person.
Yep.
And they're making it him, because he has the charisma to carry out that coat.
How fast he's shooting up through the ranks has really pissed a lot of people off. He's been there forever.
I mean, so we've got two building blocks now. We're building a damn house here. Rasputin first met Nicholas in November 1905 at the Peterhof Palace. The Tsar recorded the event in his diary, writing that he and his empress consort, Alexandra Fyodorovna, had made the acquaintance of a man of God, Grigory, from Tobolsk province. At some point, Nicholas and Alexandra became convinced that Rasputin possessed the miraculous power to heal their only son, Tsarevich Alexei Nikolaevich, who suffered from hemophilia. What's hemophilia also known as, Keith?
The royal's disease.
Because?
Because they're inbred.
There we go. Not in this case, though.
I'm pretty sure that a lot. Well, they said they married her cousin there, the Anastasia.
Well, but Alexander was German.
Yeah. Well, so was the queen.
Nicholas wasn't.
Line goes through there too.
Not sure.
They were all related. It goes from the Habsburgs down to the Spanish too, fair. And they were part Habsburgs. The Spanish were. That's what you could tell by their jaws. Ugh. Their jaws and their blood loss.
All right. Much of Rasputin's influence with the imperial family stemmed from the belief by Alexandra and others that he had on several occasions eased Alexei's pain and stopped his bleeding. The Tsarina had a passionate attachment to Rasputin, believing he could heal her son's affliction, which makes sense. If she really did believe that, I could see why he was, looked upon so fondly by them. Harold Schuckman wrote that Rasputin became an indispensable member of the royal entourage, which is going to get him some heat. It's going to get him some heat. November 1906, Rasputin suddenly paid a visit to the Baratinsky family in Kazan and told them he could read people's minds. So that's something new he's developed.
Yeah, he got an power.
Yeah, sure. Now people are looking at him like he's, some wild, crazy wizard.
Yeah.
And, now he gets to make up his own superpowers.
Get out of here, Wong.
During the summer of 1912, Alexei developed a hemorrhage in his thigh and groin, which caused a large hematoma. In desperation, Alexander asked Virabova to send Rasputin, who was in Siberia at the time, a telegram asking him to pray for Alexei. Rasputin wrote back quickly, telling the Tsarina that God has seen your tears and heard your prayers. The little one will not die. And don't let the doctors bother him too much. The next morning, Alexei's condition was unchanged, but Alexander was encouraged by the message and regained some hope that he would survive. His bleeding stopped, and the following day, Dr. S.P. Fedorov, who was one of the physicians who attended to the family and Alexei specifically, admitted that the recovery was wholly inexplicable from a medical point of view.
Or you quit prod on the kid for a minute and let him heal.
I've cut him 18 times. He won't stop bleeding.
Yeah, exactly. Because isn't that how they tried before? With bloodlines
and stuff? Yeah, leeches and stuff. Later, Dr. Fedorov admitted that Alexandra couldn't be blamed for seeing Rasputin as a miracle man. And I agree. Rasputin would come in, walk up to the patient, look at him and spit. The bleeding would stop in no time. How could the Empress not trust Rasputin after that? I'm not sure if that's a quote that's being... like he's being a smartass, or if he really did walk in and spit
on the floor, and the kid, he's healed.
Maybe. As Rasputin became closer and closer with the royal family, he naturally became also close with the children. He was even permitted to visit them in their nursery. At one point, the rumor mill began to ramp up again after someone saw him leaving the nursery after the girls present were known to be in their nightgowns. When the nurse who suspected foul play aired her grievances on the matter, she was promptly fired. So she took her complaints to other members of the imperial family, who were scandalized. Of course they were. They already hated the guy anyway. Right? Yep. By all accounts, these visits were completely innocent, but the gears were now beginning to turn, and they would turn harder when in 1910 a nursery governess and former follower of Rasputin made claims that he had raped her. It was whispered in society that Rasputin had seduced not only Alexandra, but also the four grand duchesses. Rasputin had released ardent letters written to him by the Tsarina and the Grand Duchesses, which circulated throughout society and fueled the rumors. Pornographic cartoons also circulated that depicted Rasputin having sex with the Tsarina, with her four daughters, and Anna Virabova, nude in the background. Nicholas ordered Rasputin to leave St. Petersburg for a time, much to Alexandra's displeasure, and Rasputin went on another pilgrimage, this time to Palestine. Rasputin soon became a controversial figure, if he wasn't enough, as he was accused by his enemies of religious heresy and rape and was suspected of exerting undue political influence over the Tsar. Opposition to Rasputin's influence grew within the Eastern Orthodox Church. The local clergy in his hometown of Pokrovskoye, denounced Rasputin as a heretic, and the bishop of Tobolsk launched an inquest into his activities, accusing him of spreading false Christ-like doctrines, which is that religious sect that we mentioned at the beginning. In St. Petersburg, Rasputin faced opposition from even more prominent critics, including the Prime Minister Peter Stolypin. Having ordered an investigation into Rasputin's activities, Stolypin confronted Nicholas but did not succeed in reining in Rasputin's influence or exiling him from St. Petersburg. During this period, the First World War, the dissolution of feudalism, and a meddling government bureaucracy all contributed to Russia's rapid economic decline. Many laid the blame on Alexander and Rasputin. Far-right politician Vladimir Purishkevich stated in November 1916 that he held the Tsar's ministers had been turned into marionettes, marionettes whose threads have been taken firmly in hand by Rasputin and the Empress Alexandra Fyodorovna, the evil genius of Russia, and the Tsarina, who has remained a German on the Russian throne and alien to the country and its people. She was a German princess.
Now, there's a lot of that, though. Back then, they married all the daughters all over Europe. I mean, the Italians to the Spanish to the French to the, what would have been Scottish, British, Norman. Because Normans were the big ones conquering at the time after the Viking Age.
Yeah, yeah.
They took everything. Went to Jerusalem, took it too.
Yeah. 1914, a 33-year-old peasant woman named Chionia Guseva attempted to assassinate Rasputin by stabbing him in the stomach outside his home in Pokrovskoye. I know that's wrong. Rasputin was seriously wounded, but after surgery and some time in the hospital in Tyumen, he recovered. Guseva was a follower of Iliador, a former priest who had supported Rasputin before denouncing his sexual escapades and self-aggrandizement in December of 1911. A radical conservative and anti-Semite, Iliador, a great guy, had been part of a group of establishment figures who had attempted to drive a wedge between Rasputin and the imperial family in 1911. When his efforts failed, Iliador was banished from St. Petersburg and was ultimately defrocked. I'm not going to do that joke I did earlier. Guseva claimed to have acted alone, having read about Rasputin in the newspapers and believing him to be a false prophet and even the Antichrist. Both the police and Rasputin, however, believed that Iliador had instigated the assassination attempt. Iliador fled the country before he could be questioned, and Guseva was found to be not responsible for her actions by reason of insanity. A group of nobles led by Purishkevich, Grand Duke Dmitry Pavlovich, and Prince Felix Yusupov decided that Rasputin's influence over Alexandra threatened the Russian Empire. They concocted a plan in December of 1916 to kill Rasputin, apparently by luring him to the Yusupov's Moika Palace. According to legend, once there, he was given poisoned wine and tea cakes. But when he did not die, the frantic Yusupov shot him. Rasputin collapsed, but was able to run out into the courtyard, where he shot him again.
Jeez.
The conspirators were then said to have bound him and threw him in a hole in the ice into the Neva River, where he finally died by drowning. Goddamn.
Or cold, being in the ice. Hypothermia.
However, subsequent autopsy largely refuted the accounts of events, and apparently he was only shot to death.
You can understand if he got in the cold, though, how he was so well-preserved afterwards.
But this is like... The air around this man is in so much contention that they would even grandize his death to make him seem more superhuman. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he's probably just the dude, like, yes, living it up.
Lying,
you know,
to everybody.
And maybe he wasn't even lying. He was just going along with the rumors, you know? Yeah, like
that too.
Anyway.
Get called a beast for so long, you become one.
Yeah. The murder merely strengthened Alexander's resolve to uphold the principle of autocracy, but a few weeks later, the whole imperial regime was swept away by revolution. It's possible, and maybe even probable, that one of the most despised, depraved, and wicked men in Russia in the early 1900s was an innocent man from start to grisly finish. His reputation was fueled by rumors, revenge, and jealousy. We've clearly given that information. Like a giant hog-slaying serpent monster in Carmi, Illinois. Yeah, we're looking at you, Big Jim. He was probably just a flesh and blood creature that was doing what he thought was best and making his life as prolonged and safe as he could. But when rumors began to spread and stories began being told around the campfire, he himself became viewed as a giant slithering monster out to ruin the lives of not just a small town, but of an entire country. Mother Russia.
Mother Russia. Don't look up Rasputin's jar on the internet.
Do not look up Rasputin's jar.
That book at work. I remember they took them all away and threw them away on us when we went on Christmas break. All our National Geographics, everything. They're like, you can't educate yourselves in the break room. Yeah.
Well, that catalog wasn't much of an education. Well, it was an education in some ways.
Yes.
Anyway. That's a personal size tangent that we're not going to.
Yeah, it's a running joke between us.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, these are two examples of real monsters, I think. I think it's a good representation. Yep. It's a
both sides, natural and human.
Yeah.
Beast and man.
Yeah. And anything can be projected to be anything, you know?
We throw a lot of terms around loosely, too, now these days.
We sure do. Was Rasputin really all that he was rumored to have been? I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I just think he was trying to use religion to get ahead, really.
Yeah, sure. And that definitely doesn't happen today.
Nope. But everybody else knows the stories afterwards. They made a Disney movie about it.
And yeah. Yeah.
But is that fiction or is that true? Nah. Since come to find out that more than likely it's fiction. Yeah. That Anastasia died.
Yeah.
During the raid and all that good stuff.
Yeah, who knows, man. But two real monsters. I think I'd be more afraid to run into Big Jim.
I think I would too. 12-foot rattlesnake.
92 rattles.
Yeah.
Or was it 29? Either way, it's
28, 29. Whatever. It was big, yeah.
Yeah, either
That's
way.
That's like that.
Could you imagine?
Yeah, seeing that coiled up, just going like this.
God. Guys, thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Paranormal Patio. We're on season 5 now, so you can always go back and look at old episodes in the archives. I'm also going to be giving you the hotline number. That's right, hotline number. You can call us, leave us a voicemail. You can even text us, Keith. Did you know this?
They could text us. Oh, man, how many texts would it take? Good story and a long one. Yeah. Long-winded, 12 texts. That'd be awesome. That would be, though.
If you would like to, you know. If you just want to say, hey, love the show, thanks for doing it, that's awesome. You want to say, hey, the show sucks, don't do that again, no problem.
Yep.
We appreciate constructive criticism.
Yeah.
This is not either of our personal phone numbers. You will not get a personal phone call type of thing. I'm not going to answer the phone. You can leave me a voicemail. You can be as anonymous as you want.
You can tell your name, where you're from.
Yeah.
No judgment.
None. Absolutely none. No stories too crazy. You've seen some of the emails I get.
I've said crazy stories on here and how many people tell me I'm full of shit.
Yeah, I know.
Everybody, every time I tell somebody, you're full of shit.
Anyway, oh, bro. I'll put the number on the screen, too, if you're watching this on YouTube. It is 765-665-6488. And I wonder if there's a cool, like, you know, like letter, like
combination for it. Maybe. We'll have to look that up.
Anyway. Yeah, we're looking forward to hearing from you. Feedback, if you have a story you'd like us to talk about. If you'd like to come on the show, possibly, and share a story, that's also cool,
too. Yeah, we'll interview you. That'd be awesome.
That'd be great. Anyway, phone number again, 765-665-6488. You can always email us, paranormalpatio@gmail.com. Find Paranormal Patio on social media or right here on YouTube. You can use the comments and give us a like if you like this episode. Make sure you're subscribed everywhere. All that stuff, Keith, that everybody always says, every single piece of media that's put out today.
Everything. You got to get the numbers up. Those rookie numbers. That's what they say. Get them numbers up.
I don't really care. This is more for me. You know?
It's more fun.
And if I can help other people that are also into this stuff and have no one to talk to and no outlet for
outlet. Because there is a lot of people, like I said, that's why all the stuff's coming out nowadays, because people didn't talk about this kind of stuff 50 years ago.
It's getting better, but it's still rough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's getting better. Well, they're starting to pull a lot of the fictitiousness out of it and a lot of the old stories that people were wanting to get claim to fame from. Because then you did see Bigfoot. That was claim to fame. You had a video after the whole Patterson-Gimlin.
Yep. Yeah. Not anymore so much.
No. They still try to debunk that to this day. There's no scene on a costume. Hits are moving too flawlessly if you watch it.
That costume would have cost so much money.
Is that point in time? Yeah. Who made it? Tom Savini?
From the crib, I made that. No. He could do it if anyone could.
Yeah, he could.
He's awesome.
Yeah, he was. Savini's 80 awesome. More 80s horror movie props. Man. So great.
All practical.
Yeah.
I loved it. Anyway, that's Real Monsters. We'll be back next time. We're going to talk about something else that has a bit of a misconception around it, I think. And we're looking forward to sharing that with you. Until then, I've been Jason.
This has been Keith.
That's Keith right there. We said it twice, so you know it's true.
Yep.
We'll catch you on the next one.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can also visit www.paranormalpatio.com for links to this and other episodes, as well as become a Patreon member. For just $3 a month, you'll get access to this and future episodes in video format and get them before anyone else. For your hosts, Jason and Keith, I'm your mysterious narrator, CJ Wilwright, and this is Paranormal Patio. The Season 5 theme song is provided by Carl Casey at White Bat Audio.